The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
But first, we will talk about Gaza because the situation there becomes more dire by the day. And I'm joined now by Alistair Campbell, former Downing Street Director of Communications and Strategy and co-host with Rory Stewart of the Rest Is Politics podcast. Alistair, good morning.
Hi, Pat. Why did you play the
Even as I played it, I felt for you, Alistair.
I mean, I was
2-0, and you thought, well, we've got them on the run, and then.
Yeah. And then VAR steps in and gives them a penalty. Awful.
Yeah, but VAR stepped in and denied them a penalty earlier.
I'm not sure about that, actually. No.
All right. We'll agree anyway. To differ on that one.
Yeah.
Anyway, Alistair, I was listening to your question and answer podcast over the weekend, and you started with Gaza, and you listed a set of statistics which was absolutely horrifying. And it's not just about the destruction of human life, it's the destruction of everything.
Well, yeah, as I said there in the clip that you played, it's the ecosystem. And these figures all came from an official report by this body, the IPC, which looks at famine and analyzes famine. It's the first time they've returned to one area on five different occasions. So just to give you some more, 62% of the road network destroyed, 82% of agricultural wells destroyed, 71% of greenhouses, 90% of cropland, 26% of sheep have survived. And as Rory Stewart pointed out in the podcast, you know, you can argue that when, as the Israelis do, that they're always targeting Hamas terrorists, and sometimes civilians get caught in the crossfire, as it were. But sheep, goats, 1.4% of poultry in Gaza have survived. I mean, this is of a scale that is really, really, really hard to fathom. And then, you know, you talk about children and their health. Almost half of children had diarrhea during July, 58% had fever, 25% acute respiratory episodes, and half of children now have serious skin conditions. I mean, this is just, it's on a level that we can barely fathom. And the problem with the way that, you know, the whole issue is now debated, and it's almost like we become numb to hearing this stuff. And of course, the other thing that we don't see much of it because the media, the international media is not allowed in there, and over 200 journalists who are there have now been killed.
What about the equivocation by some of the European countries? I mean, some still supplying weaponry to Israel to perpetrate all of this kind of stuff. And even though there is an option there very quickly for the European Union to stop its trade with Israel, because Israel has now broken all of the caveats that apply to that trade deal, they still trade.
They do. And I think, look, these are really difficult judgments that governments have to make the whole time. I mean, we had this when we were I was working with the Labour government in all sorts of different areas, where you continue to do business with countries that are doing things that you find difficult or offensive. And the politics of this are unbelievably difficult and unbelievably complicated. But I think the one thing I don't think anybody can say is that Israel is behaving in a legal or proportionate way. And, you know, thank you for mentioning the podcast. When October the 7th happened, Rory Stewart and I sat down and said, listen, this is going to get so polarized. It's going to get so difficult in terms of the public debate. We should try to be fair to both sides at all times, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I think that I find it very, very hard to see this as anything other than genocide. And the truth is that you see the leader, when you say that, and lots of people who support Israel get very, very offended, but you just have to listen to what they say. Listen to what Ben-Gvir and Smotrich are saying. They are actively destroying the possibility of a two-state solution. They're actively, I would argue, exploiting what happened on October 7th, horrible as it was, to bury the idea that there can ever be a Palestinian state. And they're openly talking about, you know, removing people from Gaza and annexing the West Bank. Well, along the way, there is going to be more and more suffering. And it seems to me that the way that the international community that we talk about has not managed to rein this in is the tragedy of our times.
Now, I was looking at something else over the weekend and, you know, the notion that, well, the Palestinians in Gaza, they elected Hamas. Now, it's a long time ago, and given a chance, maybe in the interim, they might not have re-elected them, but they did elect them. And these are people who espouse violence, the destruction of Israel and so on.
Yeah.
And then, and therefore they're being punished for that. But then you look to the West Bank, where they voted in a government that did not espouse the elimination of Israel and did not go the militaristic route. And what do they get for their pains in doing it, if you like, the right way? They got more settlements, they got more abuse, more restriction, more apartheid.
Yeah. And the thing about the settlement is that this has gone on year after year after year after year. And I think we said the last time I spoke to you about, we talked about living in an era of impunity. There was a report I saw on Channel 4 News the other night where the reporter confronted a guy who was filmed. He was an Israeli settler, part of the settler movement. He was armed. He was filmed killing a Palestinian who, you know, and the film is there. The guy, the reporter, confronts this guy, and he's laughing and he's looking at his phone. We think he's looking at pictures of what this reporter is showing him, and he's laughing. And then eventually he just sort of stands up and walks away. And that's impunity. That's basically saying, I can go around killing Palestinians, and there may be Israeli military who are watching me, but they don't care. Now that's when you ally that to some of the other elements of impunity that are happening in the world, it is no wonder that people worry that the sort of basic rules and decency that we hope govern most of our societies are eroding.
When we had Netanyahu last week talking about the tragic mishap, that was the term he used, of the journalist being killed at Nasser Hospital, but almost immediately the IDF came out with a statement saying they were after a Hamas operative, and that was their justification. And then they did what was called the double tap. In other words, they bombed or shot with a tank, I think it was. And then as people went to help those in distress, they did it again.
Yeah, which is a well-known tactic, usually associated with authoritarian states and, you know.
And the IRA did it too. I mean, there's no
indeed,
question.
Indeed, you, absolutely. So, you know, I think that this just underlines my point about the horror. And I think more and more people so frustrated and so agitated about it, there is an element, I think, of us becoming almost immune to the shock. And it's hard, because every single day, not just in relation to Gaza, but other things around the world, you kind of wake up, you listen to the news and you think, God, I'm not sure I can cope with more of this. And then people start to turn away. And I think that, you know, I saw recently a kind of before and after aerial. It was drone footage of the reality of Gaza on the ground. And it is just incredible, the change. And if you're Ben Gavir or you're Smotrich, and I suspect if you're Netanyahu as well, you think, well, you know, that's job done. That's what we're setting out to do. But of course, they're doing it, particularly from Netanyahu's perspective, constantly saying it's just about destroying Hamas. But as you say, in so many of these situations where they've killed women, they've killed children, they've killed journalists who are trying to tell the world what's going on, and it's always, you know, it was justified because we took out somebody from Hamas. Well, you don't see the names, you don't see the faces. It's just, the feeling is, it's hard to escape the feeling that they basically think, in part because they've got the support of the United States, they think we can do what the hell we want.
And we'll come to that backing of the United States in a moment, which is so crucial to Putin in Ukraine and Netanyahu in Gaza. But that question of how long this can go on, how big the resistance is in Israel. I mean, more and more voices realizing that the hostages will never come back if the IDF continue what they're doing, that the hostages will invariably be either killed by their captors or killed by incoming bombardment by Israel.
Yeah, but also the so they say that their goal, their strategic and their military goal is to destroy Hamas, and you can understand why they want to do that. As you say, Hamas, an organization that you know is absolutely open about, does not believe that Israel has the right to exist. It did what it did on October 7th and has done plenty before, but just. You know, we talk about radicalization sometimes. Imagine if you are a child that's growing up in Gaza today, about what your attitude is likely to be towards Israel. So the idea that they can destroy an organization, an ideology, a belief, when actually, to some extent, they are fueling the thinking of that ideology. And that's why I think that ultimately this is a catastrophe for Israel. Mm. They may feel like they're winning it, but where it ends, I mean, heaven knows. And as you say, the resistance and the anger about the government, it seems to be growing rather than receding. And if you go back to pre-October 7th, of course, I mean, look, Netanyahu. I mean, I've met Netanyahu several times with Tony Blair because, of course, he's been around for a long, 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 long time. He's been, if you tot up all the years he's been prime minister, he's been there, you know, he's not far off Putin longevity. And the fact is that before October the 7th, he was clinging on. He had all the protests about his changes to the Supreme Court, and he and what has happened, I think, since the war, since October 7th, is that it's hard to escape this conclusion that he's seized it as an opportunity for his own political survival. And that is cynicism of a pretty horrific scale, I'd say.
Given the scale of the death and destruction in Gaza and what is happening on the West Bank in terms of the apartheid regime that Israel is running there, I mean, there is no way that Palestinians will ever see themselves as brothers and sisters of the Israelis, even though that might have been possible, you know, decades ago. It might have been possible. It's no longer possible. But the problem that Netanyahu is conflating Zionism with Judaism, and that mm-hmm. puts every Jewish person all around the world at risk from people who would like to, in some way, avenge what's going on in Gaza.
Well, certainly you've seen in here, you've seen fairly markedly as well in Australia and in different parts of the world, rise in anti-Semitic abuse, anti-Semitic violence, etc. And I think that is something to be condemned, and there's no justification for it whatsoever. But there is no doubt that, what you say there about the way that the Israeli government has prosecuted its case in recent months, and especially since October the 7th, has helped to fuel that. And that, by the way, is not, I don't remotely justify it. I also think, by the way, I mean, I've actually been, in around London, because London maybe because it's sort of, you know, international and all that stuff. But I actually make a point sometimes of when I see people who are, for example, openly wearing symbols of their Jewishness, be it that, you know, that you can see that they're Jewish and they're being very open about that. I do sometimes stop and ask them whether they have themselves felt a rise in this anti-Semitic sentiment. And it's quite interesting, often they say, no, they haven't. They personally have not. But when you talk to the authorities and the police about the sort of, you know, the levels of it, then it is rising. So I think we should keep that in perspective. We should condemn it whenever it happens. But I think you are right that the framing of this conflict by the Israeli government does not exactly help their own cause.
And of course, there are many Jewish people around the world who are utterly critical and
Absolutely.
Condemnatory of Israel's behavior. A couple of questions coming in. Can you ask Alistair, why are many Islamic countries surrounding Gaza not supporting Gaza in a significant way? And another one asking, why doesn't Alistair demand that Hamas release the remaining hostages, because therefore the war in Gaza could end today?
Well, listen, I don't know how much power that caller thinks I might have. I'm not sure that me demanding anything leads to anything. But look, I absolutely unequivocally condemned what happened on October the 7th, and any civilized, sane person should want the hostages to be released, absolutely. But I think that the... You know, I found it difficult at the start when I first started, as it were, coming down so heavy against the Israelis. But I actually do think they have made things worse. And by the way, there was a brilliant piece. I don't know if you saw a piece in the Financial Times at the weekend. It was the front cover piece in the Life and Art section by an Israeli talking about this sense of what he felt the Israeli government had done by way of damaging Israel as a result of the way that they prosecuted this war. So look, I think your caller is right that we should keep mindful of that. But one of the points that the protesters have been making is that they believe that that Netanyahu has deliberately been prolonging this war in different ways at the expense of the opportunities that they might have had in the past to get the hostages out.
And the question of Arab nations not...
Yeah, I think that is a very, very, very good question. I think that comes down to them actually wanting, or it comes down to the point about that I made about numbing down, that we it's almost like we feel this is too big to sort of contemplate. If you go back to one of the reasons, one of the factors that people think was behind October 7th and what Hamas did was because there was the worry amongst Hamas leadership that some of the Arab nations were starting to get too close to Israel, that these sort of normalization of relations might be happening. And so I think they're just sort of, you know, stepping back and watching what happens. But I think it's a fair point. I think they could be doing a lot more. Now, some of them, by the way, I think are particularly, I think some of them are and are absolutely desperately trying to get some sort of proper negotiations going. But in general, I accept the premise of that question.
Now, when you were talking about Ukraine and the question was asked, you know, how could or is it possible that Russia could even hold the bits of Ukraine that it might get in some sort of a peace deal, that the Ukrainians who'd be living there would not be in any way friendly towards the aggressor, and it might make it impossible for Russia to, if you like, keep the peace?
Well, look, that is, you know, I was talking to somebody who is not Ukrainian, but used to live in Ukraine, who said to me that, you know, this idea of the sort of deal in the Donbass is you're basically saying, right, to Russia, you have this place now, okay, and then the people who live there, this guy was saying to me, Russia would have the power to conscript them to go and fight against Ukraine, which I thought was a very kind of, you know, telling way of saying this is nuts. And what I think Putin is banking on, if that is the deal that they try to impose upon Zelensky, and he gets Trump support in so doing, is actually a way of saying Russia wins. Another observation I heard, you know, if Russia stops the fighting, okay, peace wins. If Ukraine stops the fighting, Russia wins. Because I'm afraid at the moment I see no way that the Ukrainians can do anything other than fight on. The settlement that's being proposed is not going to stop the war.
Now, I want to move on to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which people may not have heard of. They've heard of the BRICS countries before, but this is an organization comprising China, India, Russia, Pakistan, Iran, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, and Belarus. Big meeting going on, I suppose President Xi is the one responsible for gathering all these people together. So Modi's there having the row with Trump. Putin is there having Trump in his pocket. And Xi is there in a standoff on trade with Trump. It's a kind of a strange world we're living in where you get all of these people who may or may not be allied with each other.
Well, certainly the and I've just I was just looking at the New York Times, and there was a picture of Modi and Putin arriving together holding hands. And of course, if you think that just last week, India taking the hit day one of the 50% tariffs being imposed, and the reason, the stated reason that Trump gave for the escalation of the tariff, the rising of the tariff, was actually was the fact that Russia, that India was continuing to buy oil from Russia. Well, China buys more oil from Russia, but there was no such imposition there. I actually, honestly, I aired this idea a few weeks ago. I think this sort of newfound hatred of Trump seems to have for Modi is because Modi pushed back on the idea that Trump was responsible for the ceasefire in India-Pakistan. And while the Pakistanis have backed this nonsense that Trump should get the Nobel Peace Prize, the Indians have said absolutely nothing about it. I think it's as simple as that. But what it's done is given Xi Jinping the opportunity. If you think, for example, that for, you know, it's been several decades now that the Americans have been trying to improve relations with India, not least as a bulwark against China. And now here is Trump basically pushing Modi into not into Xi's arms, because they've still got, you know, they've still got their differences over all sorts of issues. But certainly the three of them together, if you look at the pictures, they sort of look like a group of people who think, you know, we're the people. So this is a big deal. We're actually going to talk about this in the podcast tomorrow. I think this is it's probably the most important thing going on in the world right now.
I mean, when you look at the combination of their populations, they dwarf the United States quite dramatically in number.
Well, and of course, the other thing that they think that they're winning the battle, if you like, particularly Xi Jinping and Putin, that democracy is failing, and the only kind of alternative to democracy is the kind of autocratic dictatorships that they have. And of course, they see Trump essentially trying to take America down that road as well. So I was in Singapore at a few days ago, and I was speaking to a conference of people from different sectors, mainly energy and insurance. And I did a show of hands about who they thought were the most powerful country in the world, and they thought it was China. Who they thought was going to do best out of the tariffs war, and they thought it was China. Who was doing more damage to global stability, and they thought it was America. That is the Trump effect, I'm afraid. There's no getting around that.
Alistair, thank you very much for joining us on the programme. Alistair Campbell, who's co-host with Rory Stewart of the podcast The Rest Is Politics.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.